Quentin Jones is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas. Death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Jones to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will air live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for half the executions in the U.S. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie, Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Linda Snyder, and special guest Hank Lamb, host of the prison show. The execution watch for Quentin Jones begins. Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people?
Hello, and welcome to the Wednesday, May 19th special edition of Execution Watch. Tonight, you're joining us in vigil as the state of Texas plans to execute Quentin Jones for the September 11th, 1999 murder of his 83-year-old great aunt and theft of her property. Whether you're listening live on our FM channel 90.1 FM Houston, simulcast and archived at kpft.org, or on Houston Media Source, thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Marlo Blue. If you're tuning in for the award-winning show Arab Voices with producer Ho Saeed, normally you're heard here every Wednesday, he will be back next week. Please continue to support him as we go through KPFT's pledge drive. Tonight, we're going to be joined by our in-house experts, as always, Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie. And first, let's go to our reporter from Death Row itself, or excuse me, let's okay. go to Linda Snyder. Linda.
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Linda. Tell us what's going on there in Huntsville.
Right now, we're just waiting for the people to cross the line going into the death chamber. The cars are still, they won't close the road off, so they're about to run over us.
And we're waiting on a decision from the Supreme Court.
So the Supreme Court denied him.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they denied him.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Well, that's terrible. I see that there's a crowd of people out there.
Yes. Everybody is very sad. The whole Reed family is here.
Now, that's Rodney Reed's family?
Rodney Reed's family. This is Rodney Reed's mother. I'm getting up on the camera.
Hi.
Hello, Mrs. Reed. How are you?
So hard.
Can you hear? You probably can't hear her. She's asking you how you are.
Oh, I'm doing okay. It's just so hard, baby. This is my first visual, whatever you call it.
Yes, ma'am.
And it is so emotional.
Well, you're very brave, and I think that you've been doing a wonderful job getting out the message that Rodney needs to be acquitted.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And who's that?
Pardon?
Who's that with you?
Oh, this is Leonard.
Hi, Leonard.
Say hi, Leonard.
How are you?
We're well, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Is there any news on Rodney's case that you want to share with us?
No, except that I hope that you know that the hearing will be is scheduled for July 19th. And we're having a big event on the 17th. That Saturday before the hearing, and hope you guys come out. And we're going to do a big protest that the weekend before the hearing.
Ms. Reed, I know that you've gotten a lot of publicity for
yes.
Rodney, and we're very pleased to see that people are trying to make a difference.
Yes, thank you, too.
And there you go. All of our listeners, if you have never been to Huntsville to see what's going on, this is how this starts. We're going to be talking back with Linda Snyder, and Linda will be telling us when the wickets has crossed the road. Ms. Reed, do you mind giving the earphones back to Linda?
Yes, I will. Thank you.
And you are in our thoughts, Ms. Reed.
Thank you.
Okay. So, Linda, do we know who's going to be witnessing for Quinton?
He doesn't have any witnesses. He didn't want to need any witnesses.
Okay. All right. And basically, you know, it's been a while since we have done this. What do people on death row think about Quinton?
As far as I know, everybody liked him. He was a very liked person. He was a very sweet person, and he was a very changed man.
We know.
I saw him last week when I was visiting.
Yeah, please.
And I couldn't see his smile. He has such a beautiful smile.
Yeah.
Oh, there's Marlo.
Hello, Gloria. This is Gloria Brubeck.
Anyway, he had his mask on, so I couldn't see his smile. Mm. And one of his nicknames is GQ, because he's a very handsome young man.
He is very handsome, yes.
He is a good-looking man. He certainly is. Gloria, thank you for bringing all the people over there and getting people out for this. I wish the weather was better.
I said, Gloria, thank you for bringing all the people out.
What did you?
Thanks for being there.
Oh, hell yeah. I will be here. I'm going to be 75 this year. I am not going to die till this whole death house here is disassembled and sent to hell.
Understood.
So thank you for doing execution watch.
Thank you. Get you. I like the bullhorn. Go for it.
Okay.
Linda, will you please let us know when people go across? When the witness cross?
I will let you know.
Okay. Thank you so much. That again was Linda Snyder, and she is reporting from Huntsville for us, and we certainly appreciate that. Let's bring in our experts right now, Larry and Mike. Maybe you can give us a little rundown on what's going on, or how did we get to this point, gentlemen?
Right. And Michael, before I go any further, let me just correct my oversight and not recognizing Pat McCann, an appellate lawyer who's with us. So we're glad to have him here, and we're going to interview him. We're going to talk to him a little bit later after you and I talk a little bit about the case. But as you know, this is a case of this case of Quinton Jones started back on September 11, 1999. Okay. And it's an interesting case in that his great aunt, Berthina Bryant, although she had about an income of about $500 a month, she had a practice of loaning money to people, including her great nephew, Quinton. And on that day, now Quinton had a pretty rough upbringing, had been abused, had been both physically and sexually, and also had been introduced to drugs at a very young age. He was a drug addict, and his practice was from time to time to borrow money from his great aunt. Now, this day, she just flat refused to loan him any money. And she had a bad feeling about that because she mentioned to her sister she felt bad about it. Well, that same day that she was murdered, beat to death using a baseball bat. And I think the authorities probably had a good idea that might have been Quinton because they arrested him the next day on a traffic warrant and possession of a controlled substance. And they interviewed him. And initially he denied it, but then after a while, they did Mirandize him. They gave him his statutory warnings. and he gave a confession to the murder. But part of the confession, he mentioned that he had an alter ego by the name of James. He tried to put it all on James. So this being a murder in the course of committing a robbery became a capital murder. And Michael, you can unmute yourself anytime and jump in anytime you get ready to, Michael. You're muted right now. But anyway, he was tried for capital murder and convicted of capital murder. And the appellate process was a lot to be desired in terms of the quality of his assistance in the appellate process. But in any event, one of the most interesting issues I thought on appeal and on the collateral practice was the whole idea of his warnings regarding two other murders. Now, although he was a drug addict and had something of a troubled life, this man had never been to prison before in his life. Never. When they did everything seemingly right for the confession for the murder of his great aunt, but then one of his sisters mentioned that she thought he might have been involved in two other murders, and so another officer came and picked him up and started to interrogate him about those other two murders. And he initially denied those. The officers kept working on him, and then got him to actually write out a full confession for the other two murders. And after that full confession was written out, and he was preparing to have him sign that written confession on the other two murders, then the officer says, wait a minute. What I need to do now is give you your statutory warnings. So at that point, he gave him a statutory warnings. And then when the statutory warnings were given, right before he signed the confession they'd been working on for quite a while, then he had him sign the form regarding the warnings. And so this proved to be an issue at trial, in that the state did not use, as they should not have, and probably would not have been allowed to use that confession of the other two murders as part of the guilt innocence phase. They did use it as punishment, and it was recognized by the appellate court that using that un-Mirandized confession at the punishment phase was error, but that it was not a reversible error. And that I think is one of the more interesting issues about this case in my mind. What are your thoughts, Michael?
Well, what you describe very well is what happened before the murder. What I find interesting is what's happened since the murder. One of the things about this show we've often said is that the person we are executing is not the same person who committed the crime. And this is a prime example of that. This boy was in his 20, he was 20 when this happened.
Right.
He had a horrible life, horrible abuse. The fact that she was in the practice of lending him money makes the question, well, was it robbery or was it a business transaction? The bottom line is she was murdered, and he was painted as being a hard, cold-blooded murderer. They came in with these other two murders to reinforce that view, but those are the two murders I do not believe he committed. I think the man with him committed, who was an older man and was a white man. The interesting part is that the older white man who supposedly committed these murders is still alive in prison, and yet this young black man is on death row. What the critical part of this is supposed to be is how has he been doing in prison. The purpose of the death penalty is to protect inmates from dangerous people. If somebody has committed a capital murder, life in prison is the proper punishment, unless he is such a dangerous nature that he's a danger to other inmates. This man is not a danger to other inmates. In fact, one of the things that was on appeal on his case was the way they proved that. The state tried to prove he was a future danger by giving him a written exam. A written exam does not help anybody tell his future problem. This man had never been in jail. He was barely a man. He was only 20. He had never been in jail, never been in custody. The things he did in a drug-induced state. Nobody knows whether or not he was a future danger to society or not. And yet they painted him as a future danger based upon a written exam. That written exam has been criticized. That written exam has been reversed in other cases. That written exam should not have been the reason he was executed. The only thing that's relevant in execution is how you act in prison. You don't get executed for the crime you committed. You get executed because of your future dangerousness, because of your future danger to society. There's no evidence that he ever was. The other interesting thing about this case is the fact that he filed two motions to disqualify the DA's office that were kind of interesting. One motion was to disqualify the DA in the Tarrant County because the DA who was handling the appeal was the trial judge in his trial. And the concept is, how can the judge who sentenced him be the appellate lawyer on his appeal? So that was one motion they filed to disqualify the DA. The second motion they filed was to disqualify a DA appellate lawyer who was actually one of his lawyers in his original trial. And the same question becomes is, how can you be his lawyer at one stage of the proceeding and be on the opposite side during the other stage of the proceeding? They use the idea of that you can be isolated, that you can be in the DA's office and isolate yourself and not talk about the case to other people in DA's office, but we all know that's kind of impossible to do and kind of hard to do. The third interesting thing about this case is the fact that even his family members, the family members of the victim, do not want him executed. When the family members of the victim does not want a man executed, that just speaks volumes in terms of our justice system. If the family members don't care, and they know him better than we do, and they think he deserves life in prison, who are we to say he doesn't deserve it? I also think this is a racial situation. I think if he was white, he would not have this problem. I think he'd be looking at life in prison rather than the death penalty. I think he got the death penalty because of his race, because of the drug addiction, because of the unfortunate part of his life before he was 20. But again, nobody's looked at what he's done in prison, how he's changed his life.
At this point, let's bring in Pat McCann. Larry?
Yeah, Pat, since you are a death penalty lawyer, appellate lawyer, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my first thought is, first, thank you for having me on. And second, my heart goes out to Michael Mola, who's been representing this man through his post-conviction process. And I understand just got turned down by the Supreme Court on his review of the CCA's, the Court of Criminal Appeals, latest denial. An issue of intellectual disability was brought up, and sadly did not get a favorable review from the Court of Criminal Appeals. And my understanding is that the Supreme Court has denied review of that as well. So it looks like that may be the last obstacle to Mr. Jones being executed.
And then, Michael, the point you raised about race, I mean, I've especially on the clemency issue, I guess this governor is only given clemency in one time in the past, and that was to Bart Whitaker at the request.
And that was a case similar to this case. But, you know, the problem with racism is the fact that so many things happen to you when you're born on the wrong side of the track that makes you look like a worse person than you are. You can't help your neighborhood. You can't help your family. You can't help where you were born. What you can help is the decisions that you make. Racism becomes an issue when people assume somebody is something they're not just because of where they were born. racism is not always a question of race. Sometimes it's a question of just economic racism. People from the poor part of town don't have the same opportunities as people on the other part of town. We look at that in terms of death penalty cases, in terms of they're dangerous because they had such a hard life. It doesn't mean they're dangerous. It just means that they've had a hard life.
If I may jump on some of that, Larry, for a second, in terms of the clemency, I hope you won't mind my speaking on this, but I've been studying this for Governor Abbott for some time, and frankly, this is probably the stingiest governor with commutation pardons and executive clemency across the board, let alone in a death penalty context. I know we all tend to focus on that, and especially today, but this governor has given so little relief to folks across this state that I think, you know, some of the original founders would find it very hard to recognize as a place with no second chance, period, for anybody, let alone those facing condemnation and execution. And on Bart Whitaker, you know, the frustrating thing on that is, and I'll just say it, it's a rich white family that asked for commutation and got it. And the family here on a poor black man didn't. And that has been, frankly, the story of commutation here for some time.
And then just on that point right there, in terms of the Bart Whitaker as compared to Quentin Jones, you know, Bart's dad did really force the issue of trying to get on the clemency issue. But by the same token, the victim in this case, the great aunt, the person that she confided in was her sister, saying that, you know, I feel kind of bad about, I feel like I'm in some danger for having this time not loaned him some money. And this very sister is the one that came forward and said, you know, I now forgive Quentin for what he did. I understand, you know, that my sister's gone, but I in my heart forgive Quentin for what he did. And this is a person, Quentin, who'd never been in prison before, and it's never been a problem in prison at all. So to Mike's point regarding the person who's being executed, it's hard to go back. I mean, because once the decision is made, that is by the jury, to impose the death penalty, the penalty of death, you know, then it's a matter of the appellate procedure and the collateral procedures are all looking for either reversible error or something having gone wrong below.
Is there anybody that doubts if the actual decision on life and death was made today rather than when the crime happened, that his behavior in prison and how he's acted would mean life in prison and not execution?
No, I honestly, in fact, Harris County, which up until a few years ago and the change in administration, had been notorious for retrying folks who got relief and punishment, they have actually declined to seek death again in a number of cases where they felt that based on a modern review of those cases, that it would be inappropriate to seek death because they wouldn't do it now.
Let me say that, something we've talked in prior shows. The crime is life in prison. The punishment is death if you're continuing danger to society. The question is, does that last decision of continuing danger, does that have to be made when the crime is committed, or can that be made 5 or 10 years later after he's been in jail? Does not the fact that he's acted well in jail and not been a danger a factor on his execution?
That's a tougher answer, honestly, and that has come down to, for instance, in a number of cases, for instance, if you had looked back about 8 years ago, There were a number of cases coming back, all on what we would call Penry error, the failure of a question of mercy. That's the last special issue. Those cases were almost completely retried in Harris County and got death, even though some people had flawless records. Now, under a change in administration, to Kim Ogg's credit, there has been a review of a number of them, and they have taken a look at the behavior in prison and sometimes declined to seek death again. So it's a, it's perhaps not a giant step, but it is a step forward. The interesting thing on that, and this goes to your point, Larry, there's no procedure or claim that one can make that says that the future danger decision was wrong, if that makes sense. In other words, I've raised this to my frustration because there are, as Michael said, a number of times when you look at a 20-year history and there's not a disciplinary write-up in some of these guys, that in particular since they've been moved to isolation and they have limited interaction with people, there just is not a history of danger in prison. And there is no recognized claim in collateral attack, as you pointed out, Larry, or in clemency, for saying, look, the jury made its guess at the time based upon a very brutal criminal history, and it guessed wrong. There is no way to correct that within the legal system unless you either start to recognize that claim or you bring it up on clemency. And clearly, this governor is never going to find someone he doesn't wish to execute, at least if they're not white.
See, but what we're missing out on is there's lots of stories of people who did horrible things, and through being in the penitentiary under the concept of penance has made changes in their life. Those are stories that need to be told to people who are in a similar time of life. These can be success stories to a younger generation rather than just people who are executing.
I would agree.
But unfortunately, Michael, there's just no mechanism to bring that up. And even on the future danger issue, I mean, the crime itself, the jury could easily find what was enough to substantiate the finding of future danger. And in this case, the finding, even that the introduction of the confession during the punishment phase, while that was error, found to be error, it was found to be harmless error. And the court found that there was other evidence of Quentin Jones's involvement in those other two murders outside of his confession that could have been used. Now the two things that concern me about all these cases, whatever kind of case it is, prosecutorial discretion makes a real big difference, as Pat pointed out. So the attitude of the prosecutor as to whether to seek the death penalty is a critical one, because there are so many terrible cases of murder, of capital murder, that would likely receive the death penalty if they were pursued, that really don't have to be pursued. It just doesn't have to be. And in Texas, I mean, we talked earlier about Texas accounts for half of the executions in the U.S., but right now there are six people that are on a death row in the U.S. right now, pending cases. Five are in Texas. So Texas overwhelmingly populates those awaiting the death penalty.
You are listening to Execution Watch on KPFT 90.1 and on Houston Media Source TV for all people. Thank you for joining us. We've been talking with Larry Douglas, Pat McCann, and Michael Gillespie, trying to get a feel for what's going on. The state of Texas is currently, as far as we can tell, executing Quentin Jones. And this is the first electronic vigil ever produced. Execution Watch has been founded on KPFT for a while now. A little bit later on, we're going to be bringing in Hank Lamb from the prison show, so please stay tuned for that. Pat, are you, Linda, are you back with us?
Yes, I am. They say that his attorneys are with Greg Abbott at this moment, and they have not made a decision. So it looks good. They have not crossed the line. So we're hoping that they can convince Greg Abbott to stop it.
Again, to our listeners who may not be familiar with the process, as our reporter stands outside of the death house, what she's talking about is our signal that the execution is going to proceed. Are the witnesses walking across and going into actually watch the execution itself? And we do understand that Mr. Jones does not have any witnesses with him tonight. Is that correct?
He has a spiritual advisor, and that's the only one. It's not a friend or anything. It's just his spiritual advisor.
And thank you, Texas, for finally allowing that back into the chamber, which is an important aspect. Of course, there was a small moratorium on that. Is that correct, Linda? That they
They did not allow it.
Have they reenacted any, or have they allowed any of the other rituals that used to be set, like the last meal?
Oh yeah, they don't get their choice for the last meal anymore. They just get to get whatever they're having that day at prison.
All right.
And they do give them some sweets, some like donuts and stuff like that that they don't normally get. But other than that, that's nothing else special.
Nothing special. Nothing special as the state of Texas puts a man's life to death.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that I'm encouraged that his lawyers are meeting with the governor right now. That's a big plus sign.
Yes,
it is a big plus. We're happy to hear that. And Linda, where did you get that information?
From his attorney. He talked to one of the people here.
Hey, y'all, excellent. Show me your signs, and we'll take one more picture.
We'd always like to see the signs. At this point in time, again, you are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM and Houston Media Source. Thank you for joining us. This is a special edition of Execution Watch. Let's bring in Hank Lamb. Hank is the host of the longest-running radio show in the state of Texas, which is The Prison Show. Hank, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Marlo. I'm sad that it's over this sort of issue. I'd much rather be talking to you on any other subject.
Anything else in the world. That's absolutely true. For people who are not familiar with The Prison Show, it's one of the few ways that we can communicate directly. Would you say that's right?
Yeah. You know, the show basically, we've been on for 41 years. I've been doing it for about 8 years. Before that, it was the great Ray Hill, who is the man who got phones into TDCJ to begin with the Ray Hill bill, and started this show as a Texas radio intuition. And it in 1980, and it has now become a Texas radio institution. And, you know, I'm blessed to get to do it. The first hour is news, interviews, important cases, death penalty, of course, Texas death row. Miss Linda's one of our reporters as well. And the second hour, and this is where what you're talking about, is the communication lines between families and inmates. Because for the entire second hour, we turned the airwaves over to shout-outs by families, and we broadcast them, and all the people within our 100,000 watts range at KPFT, which is in fun drive, by the way, folks. You can call 713-526-5738. There, I've made my plug. You know, people can keep those lines of communication open between their loved ones that are in TDCJ and give them a live shout out on the air. Of course, right now we're pre-recording it on Zoom on Mondays to play on Friday because of the constraints of the electronic world and us being out due to COVID and other issues.
Well, you've been actually keeping up with all with everything that's going on with COVID in the system itself. And I believe you were a part of the family advocacy group calls. Is that right?
Yeah, I've been doing those since last April.
Now, tell us the progression of COVID within the system.
Okay, so the first known case, or the first shown case, was a man that came from Harris County Jail, entered the institution at TDCJ, and the spread began there. So a year ago when those calls started and everything, TDCJ was doing a pretty good job of keeping it from growing and spreading and things. But they weren't taking all the precautions necessary, like stopping inmate transfers and things, other than to medical facilities, and preventing staff from moving from building to building. And, these prisons tend to be in rural areas where people in Texas tend to poo-poo the COVID-19 problem anyway and don't want to take the precautions and that sort of thing. And staff tend to be that type of folks. So staff were carrying it in and out from building to building. Inmates were being moved and moving it from building to building, unit to unit. The numbers blew up. In the time since since pandemic started and that first case came in, about 25% of all the inmates in TDCJ have had COVID-19. And probably more than that, because it's very hard to trust the numbers TDCJ gives, and their dashboard is not user-friendly. And it's similar to the one the state uses. And the state adopted that one because it didn't give a clear picture of what was really going on with COVID. So, our politicians here in Texas, just like they don't like letting people do life in prison rather than killing them, they don't want an informed public when it comes to big issues like this. So,
well, of course, we've noticed, of course, the pandemic is basically kind of winding down in other areas. How's it going there in the system?
Okay, so as of this morning, I was on the call with TDCJ, and they are they're still struggling with it, but the situation is much better. It's not spreading as fast. They're not getting as many positive cases per day as they were. I think they said this morning that Texas had, 1,300 new cases yesterday. And I'm not sure if that's even correct because I haven't gone and checked the Texas numbers. But they have 256 staff out sick, and they entered COVID 1,300 staff short in 100 prisons, basically. There are now 99. They've closed. There were 101. Now there are 99 because they've closed two more in the last year or so. But and they're down to, I think, 123,000 inmates right now, which is the lowest it's been since the 80s, I believe. So they've handled COVID pretty well as far as the disease goes, but all the systems in TDCJ fell apart under the weight of COVID.
Right.
The food systems fell apart. The medical system just went to hell in a handbasket. The mail rooms, because of shortage of staff and that sort of thing, mail has been delayed as much as 2 months in cases. We have I just got one from October that was apparently sitting in a mail room and finally got sent out, just picked up Friday. But, that literally every system within TDCJ that goes into operating the system and taking care of the inmates and security even has really kind of fallen apart. The mail has been a big issue because last year in January they introduced new rules about the mail in order to stem the flow of drugs into TDCJ. So
is that working?
Well, they instituted the new stuff in January, and then in April, they shut down all visiting. So since April of last year, there has been no visiting at all. So visitors are not bringing it in, which is one of the big things they harp on. The mail, they've made the changes they wanted, and that was one of the big things they harp on. Well, we found out that the drug problem got worse and worse and worse as COVID went on. And if it's not the mail and if it's not families bringing it in, that leaves staff. And they've had a growing problem with cell phones in there. And the reports I get are that staff will bring those cell phones in, sell them to an inmate. The inmate will get caught with the cell phone. The staff will confiscate the cell phone and then sell it again. Can I prove that? No, but I've had reports of it from several units. So it's not just somebody made it up and somebody somewhere else made up the same rumor. So we have the drug issue that has gotten worse. And on a previous computer, the laptop I had before I got this new one, I had actually a film of that some inmate with a cell phone filmed of inmates staggering around in the yard on K2 and falling down and all that sort of thing. How is staff missing that? You know, on one of the TDCJ calls, it was suggested that drones were bringing it in. Now,
drones?
I don't know. Yes, drones.
Into a Texas prison?
Yes. Now, in the first place, you've got to be in some sort of proximity or have a very expensive drone to be far enough away to fly in drugs, a load of drugs on a drone. Is it possible? Yeah, I suppose it's possible. Is it likely? Hell no. I've seen guys cut a slit in a tennis ball, stuff it with dope, and throw it over the wall and run. I've seen that sort of thing, but it's uncommon. And I've been dealing, 28 straight years with jail and prison situations. And before that, did my time. So I'm not buying it. I know from experience kind of what the real factor there is, and it's staff. And TDCJ does not like it when I say that, and I've said it on the calls. Got upset with me.
But, Hank, have they started having hot meals again in the system?
I asked that question again last month when I asked it. They couldn't really say yes, but they have started now apparently at all the units doing the hot meals again. Now, when a unit goes on lockdown or something, they go back to Johnny Sacks, that sort of thing. That was Johnny Sacks for extended periods of time were about all that anybody got to eat in TDCJ as COVID was at its height. There were things, you'd get your sack and there'd be two corn tortillas with a spoonful of peanut butter on it, five prunes, and that was your meal. And that was a pretty typical one. But they also served things where the guys in the kitchen reported the sack said not for human consumption.
Well,
and they were, making it and serving it to people. Bad fruit, bad meat, that sort of thing. And during this time, we also found out that they've been losing a few million dollars on their own farming, which was supposed to be sort of self-sustaining for some of the food in the TDCJ. So apparently that's a bust.
Let me bring you back to a little bit more about what were you doing right now? We're talking about the guys on death row and trying to kind of get a feel for things. The last time that Execution Watch was on the air, of course, was the execution of Billy Wardlow. That was last year in the middle of the pandemic. It was a severe situation. And talking about a question of mercy, which everyone was talking about just a few minutes ago, there was a terrible scene that happened after the death of Billy Wardlow. And of course, what happens once the prisoner has been executed, they take his body to the chapel. Can you explain something of what happened?
Well, there's a woman that is a friend of the prison show who was a very close and dear friend, the closest of friends, with Billy Wardlow. And she and Billy had discussed it, and she was going to go after his execution and see him in the chapel and hold his hand and spend a couple of minutes with Billy privately, first physical contact, that sort of thing, even though it would be with his lifeless body. An employee named Gina at Carnes, the funeral home that handles these bodies, has a reputation of being rude to families of men executed or who died in TDCJ, not just death row people, but in general, and a real dislike for any inmate. And she stopped. Danny was prevented from holding his hand and spending those moments with him in the chapel. I don't know. It was a bad situation. The woman was rude and everything. A little argument ensued. Some of it is on video. Some of it is not. The part where the woman was yelling at her at the outset of this situation, it's not on the video. Nonetheless, the woman, I am told, has been taken off of any work to do with TDCJ, thankfully, but I hesitate to say what that speaks, how that speaks for Carnes itself, that they will keep an employee that will treat the families and loved ones of the deceased in that manner.
It's like stealing from the dead.
Yeah, you know.
A few moments that you actually have with someone that you love and were caring about.
TDCJ actually called her the next day. She got two calls, I believe, and they apologized to her for that situation. Because it came to their attention immediately. But
they couldn't do anything about it, right?
Right. It was, too late. They apologized to her and everything. But then later, and if I'm not mistaken, it was two chaplains. And later she reached out to them, and she's never heard another word from them since last year. And one more thing about the Billy Wardlow execution is that it was against the precautions that TDCJ had in place at the time. Mm-hmm. They had distancing, they had masks, they had all these things, but yet they brought people together in an enclosed space, et cetera, in order to perform an execution. I guess they just couldn't let the year go by without it.
Well, Hank, thank you so much for giving us a little bit more of an insight of what's going on. And, we appreciate all that you all do on the prison show. Thank you very much for all that. Let's bring Larry and Mike and Pat. Is Pat still there?
I am.
We're all here.
Yeah. While I've got all these attorneys on here, can I ask about what the U.S. Constitution has to say about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Life being the first and foremost, and yet here we are taking a life.
That's been held to be constitutional because it's actually in the Constitution. So,
So it's contradictory in a sense, and it doesn't promote the general welfare, which is in the preamble, that lays out what the Constitution is for and all about.
Again, you are listening to Execution Watch here on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, of course, live on Houston Media Source, and we thank them for their time today. This is the first time we've actually had to gather for an execution. Gentlemen, race really is a factor in this. Do you think, with all the things that are going on in the United States these days, that we will ever see any kind of changes here in Texas?
No.
Why? Are we not progressive enough? Are we?
Are we not? Did you just say that?
I'm in Houston, so yeah.
No, the decision makers in this state are going to continue to be overwhelmingly indifferent. overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly blind to the racism that anyone who works in the system would be a fool to deny. You just have to go down to watch a courthouse and anywhere in this state, in Harris County, in Montgomery County, in Brazoria County, in Fort Bend County. You'll see some things there that I think will disturb you, particularly in Harris and particularly in Montgomery, and in particular a few other places like Brazoria. And you're going to walk in and see what looks like an antebellum gathering. You know, you're going to walk into Brazoria, and the staff and clerks and judges and prosecutors will be white folk, and there will be a chain of men, black, Hispanic, and a few poor or retarded white men, that will be brought in, and they will squat down in the back, and they will be there for the entire criminal docket. So if you're going to really try and change some of this, you have to change who's in charge. You know, there's been a marked drop off in Harris County since the change of administration.
If you were in there talking to Greg Abbott right now, the governor of Texas, what would you be saying?
I would say that the God you proclaim to love, last act was to forgive the thief on the cross next to him. What makes you so smart?
What makes you so damn right? Gentlemen, Larry, Mike, you have anything else to say?
The last thing I'd like to say is that we're supposed to be a Christian country.
A lot of pain for you to carry. I mean,
based upon mercy, and yet we're acting like a Muslim country with vengeance. This is not about vengeance. It's supposed to be about mercy and love.
You know, Hank, you said something the other day that I thought was really interesting about mercy and love, as the case may be. And do you remember? Can you say it for us?
All right. So, you know, this is not about public safety. Once a man is locked up, there is no threat to the public anymore. And if you're locked in ADSEC, there's no threat to other inmates anymore. And it's about revenge. And it's for Greg Abbott or other lawmakers, it's not even, or judges or prosecutors, it's not even about personal revenge, although they will fight to make it stand, even in the face of exculpatory evidence, which we just lost a DA in Dallas because he did not turn over exculpatory evidence and hid it. He was eventually caught up with and now lost his license to practice law in Texas. It's revenge. It's that simple. And nobody gets closure out of it. You know, people talk about, well, the family of the victim will get closure. I have yet to find a family of a victim in 28 years of dealing with, you know, victims, inmates, their families on both sides. I have yet to find anybody that got closure from an execution.
Let's go back with a final check on outside of the death house right now, please, with Linda Snyder. Linda, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you right now.
Is there any other action going on?
No action going on. So we kind of think the guards are clearing out. The few that are here, we're kind of thinking they're going to put a hold on it, but we don't know.
How would we find this out?
We're not going to leave. We're not going to leave until we know something. So we'll be here.
And of course, people can check in on the Facebook page for.
Right. Yeah, on the Facebook page. Yeah.
You're with the abolition group. Is it called what is it called? I'm sorry.
Abolition. It's the Texas Abolition Group. It's Gloria.
You can get that that live feed coming out of there if you need it. All right. And again, we do know that the U.S. Supreme Court has passed on doing anything regarding his application for a stay. And at the moment, we're under the impression that Quentin Jones's lawyers are in with the governor of the state of Texas. And am I right that that's the last hope he has right now?
Yes, that's the last hope of the governor.
Is that right,
Larry,
Michael, Pat?
Yes, the last power he has is to grant a.
I hope that you can hear me. My brother
is to grant a 30-day stay.
Called Ella Song by Sweet Honey and the Rocks.
A 30-day stay.
Inspired from a speech given by
Linda, we're glad that you're out there.
So can't the governor grant clemency?
No, the Board of Pardons and Paroles voted against it. He has one 30-day stay to grant, which effectively gives you a year because they'd have to give you 90 days notice of the statute.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, as we sit here, we have not gotten any confirmation that there's actually been an execution tonight, and we're very happy for that news, and we hope it stays that way. Any closing words, Larry?
Well, just even a possibility of a 30-day stay. Okay, I'm encouraged by that. So we'll see what happens. I mean, hope springs eternal. So we'll see how it goes. But what I'm saying is, even the 30-day reprieve, if it were to come through, I'm encouraged by the efforts of his lawyers to try to save this man's life. And I'm proud that fellow brethren who practice law do such a great job in representing their clients. And in this case, this is the ultimate. I mean, this is they're doing a terrific job. They're putting forth a terrific effort.
Mike, anything else?
Well, it's just sad that if he's not executed tonight, he's got to go through the whole thing again in the future. More pain, more frustration. It's inevitable.
And it does
correct?
Affect so many people. I mean, it's not just the person himself. It's not just Quentin Jones. It's the family that's standing up for him. It's the activists that are trying so hard to save this man's life. A question of mercy. Where is it in the Texas law? I'm not seeing it at all. Well, Pat, anything else you'd like to tell?
I like to say
just best of luck to Michael Mola and his team, and our hats all should be taken off to them for the work they've done. It is, as Larry says, inspiring to see people like that take on these cases and work this hard for men that they would otherwise have nothing in common with.
Yeah, right. Well, thank you.